As entrepreneurs, we see the world differently. In a world that not only tolerates but promotes mediocrity, we unreasonably demand more. Giving you access to the world's most successful entrepreneurs and thought leaders, this podcast uncovers the untold truths of what it really takes to build a multi-million dollar business while optimizing your personal performance in every area of your life. I'm Jack DeLosa. Let's get to work. Hey team, welcome to this episode of the Jack DeLosa podcast, the place you come to master your business and elevate your life. I'm incredibly excited about today's episode with the great man sitting to my left, Mr. Tony Nash. Now, Tony is the founder and CEO of Booktopia, Australia's largest online bookstore. Against strong warnings that he was entering a dying market, Tony founded the bookstore in 2004 with a budget of just $10 a day. It took him 3 days to sell his first book. The company is now worth $113 million, sells a product every 6 seconds, and has 2 million repeat customers. Under Tony's leadership, Booktopia has been listed in AFR's Fast 100 eight times, was named Bookstore of the Year in 2016 and 2017, has been a finalist in the Telstra Business Awards 7 times, and won New South Wales Business of the Year in 2018 and Australian People's Choice Awards. Tony Nash, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Great to be here.
Good to have you here. Now, mate, you achieved 15 years of high double-digit growth year on year. What did you do day to day to enable that to happen?
Well, first of all, the business was started by asking the question, what do our customers want? Mm. That was it. Every single day we asked that question. And as we answered that, people started buying from our website. And so as time went by and we started to grow quite rapidly, I came up with this tactic to look back at what we did last year for the same month. So for example, it's going to be March next month. And I looked at, well, what did we do last year for March? And what have I got to do to be 30% more this year than I was last year? Now, maybe that sounds easy enough, but what happens when you ask that question is you actually start to think, well, what could I do? What could I come up with? And I actually remember meeting a publisher in Melbourne, one of the academic publishers, and I explained to him that that's what I did. And he goes, you've completely shattered my paradigm, because they aim for 3% growth.
Wow.
And so maybe we should be aiming a little higher. And so just that idea of focusing it. Now, if you came up short and you did 25% or 20%, that is still massive growth. Mm. I mean, that's the truth of it. Mm. So it's about that stretching and feeling like you're going for that. And quite often we were able to do it. In fact, would you believe at 113 million revenue last year, for February month to date this year, we actually are up 35% on our website. Right. So it can still keep going. It can still keep going. It's amazing.
I absolutely love that question. What are some of the common answers that you develop when you ask that question of yourself? How do we go 30% in March? What are some of the most common answers you get in terms of how you actually end up driving that revenue growth?
Look, sometimes it'd be, what could we do to, who could we partner with maybe to get that? Or how's our free shipping offer going to go this month? Or are there new releases? Like, is there some publisher that's come out with a huge book that we can back a little better? Or are there any affiliates that we can work closer with? So And as time goes by, as all those programs mature, you get to pull more levers. In the beginning, like one of the things it wasn't, and just to be absolutely clear, let's reduce our pricing. So it was never about we've got to be the cheapest. Mm. Because for us in the book business and being online, it was always about a good price, but also availability and how fast could you get it to that person. Mm. So at the end of the day, that was probably one of the biggest levers that we could pull, was adding more stock and adding more stock. And deep, because we've got 150,000 titles now in our 13,000 square meters out near the Olympic Stadium. By having that product there ready to go, most of the time, it won over the customer's decision.
Right, right. One of the things I love about your story, Tony, you often talk to me about your credentials. I'd love it if you could share some of your credentials as you see them with the audience.
Yes, well, they're not so fabulous. So basically, look, I got 56%. In my HSC. I somehow scraped into uni and mastered in Space Invaders and snooker. Failed in accounting and economics. Apparently I cannot sing one note in tune in a whole song.
That's a credential we share.
Hey, you know my wife as well, because she was the one that told me that.
Right.
And look, I've been bankrupt. And a year and a half ago, I found out that I have ADHD and I've lived with it all my life.
Mm.
So, and the reason why I like to share those credentials is because a lot of people that I meet who are entrepreneurs, they've always got some reference point of why they will not make it. Or they've got some background, or they had something that happened to them, and that's the reason. Mm. There is literally no reason why your past can dictate your future. Mm. It's really, really important. So I don't have a Harvard business degree. I didn't get my master's in business, my MBA. So that cannot predicate what sort of entrepreneur you're going to be. I think that's really important. So, and so that's why I share with people, you know, I have, and people have worse or different and more tragic backgrounds, but I don't allow that, you know, to define who I am.
Absolutely. Let's go back to the start. So you started Booktopia in 2004. You had a budget of $10 a day. It's now obviously a nine-figure revenue company and valuation company. What were the early days like, and what were some of the keys to you driving the growth the way you did?
Mm. So first of all, there was no business plan. Mm. There was no like vision or light bulb moment, because what had happened, so prior to Booktopia, we had an internet marketing company, getting people to the top of Google, driving traffic through SEO and pay-per-click management.
Right.
And when I say we, I'm in business with my brother and my sister and my brother-in-law.
Wow.
So. And so that business led us to doing some work on the Angus and Robertson website to get them to the top of Google.
Right.
And they actually outsourced their website and all of the fulfillment to a company here in Sydney who did it for them. So at the end of every month, they would get a check to say, look, this is what we sold, this is your commission, so therefore that's the relationship that they had. Now, that suited them because they had franchisees. And it was, you know, it was the early 2000s, so, you know, it's the internet. We don't know anything about that, so they could keep it at arm's length and it served them. Now, this company that managed it for them managed 80 bookstores' websites.
Mm.
So my brother had this idea of approaching them and saying, hey, remember the good job we did for Angus and Robertson, getting them to the top of Google and driving all that traffic? Why don't you introduce us to all the other bookstores and we can get them all to the top of Google and you'll make lots of money? So that meeting happened Christmas 2003, we pitched the idea to them, and the owner of the company said, "No, not interested." I said, "You're not interested in making more money?" He said, "Look, it's not our business. We manage bookstore websites and we fulfill those orders. That's what we do." So I asked, "So how does it all work? How does your business work?" And they said, "Look, we've built a system. You give us the name of your bookshop, and within 10 minutes, we can have a bookstore's website up and running with 1 million books on there. And if you sell anything, we'll pay your commission." I said, "That sounds really interesting." And the guy said, yeah, but no internet-only business has made anything of it. So I went off the back of a traditional bookstore that wanted a website. So I went away from that meeting and I went back to our office in North Sydney, which is about half the size of this room, a 60 square meter office, with my brother. As we're driving back there, I said, "You know what? I wouldn't mind giving that book thing a bit of a go. That sounds really interesting." And so it was the Christmas holidays and I was going camping up the coast of New South Wales. I was trying to come up with the name of a store and I wasn't happy with the names I was coming up with. And I was in a national park on a really hot Australian summer's day, very similar to today. And I turned to the person I was with and I said, "Oh, it's," because all these insects were screaming at the top of their lungs in this forest that we're in. And I turned to the person I was with and I said, "Oh, it's like that kids' movie Ants, where the insects talk about this place called Insectopia." I thought, Booktopia, that'd be a good name.
Wow.
But in 2003, now most of the people listening are probably too young, but we were still on dial-up modems back in 2003. Remember the sound of a dial-up modem?
Yeah.
Right, so I had to wait a whole week till the camping trip was over before I could park in front of the house, run inside, turn on the computer and go, you know, is it available? It is. We bought the URL and the business and we rang this company and said, "Look, we're going to give the book thing a go too." And within 10 minutes, we had a website with Booktopia's name up the top and 1 million books on there. And my brother, who handled the finances, said, "Look, we've got the internet marketing business. We're doing all that consulting work. You're going to have to work on Booktopia outside of hours." He gave me a forecast. For the first 3 months, you can sell one book per day we'll aim to sell one book per day for the first 3 months, and after 3 months, double it to two books a day. Right? And he gave me $10 per day to start the company. He's very generous, my brother. So that were the origins. So there was no real plan, there was no vision. It just, you know, by the end of the first month, by the third day, we sold our first book.
Yeah.
And they were the total sales for the day. So we started on the 4th of February 2004, which just happens to be the same day that Facebook started.
Wow.
We didn't know that until our 10th birthday.
Wow.
And then there's a website called the Wayback Machine. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Archive.org. Just search for the Wayback Machine. Mm. You can actually go into the Wayback Machine and put in www.booktopia.com.au, and it takes an HTML photograph of what websites look like over time.
Right.
And it just so happened, probably because it followed a Google ad, to our website on that day. And you can see what the Booktopia website looked like when we started.
Right.
It was actually really, really poor. But it was enough to get going. So by the end of the month, we had done $2,000 worth of sales. By the fourth month, I was up to $30,000 a month. By the end of the year, $100,000 a month. So I was obviously taking the proceeds that I was getting from the sale of books. I wasn't living off my $10 a day from my brother, and putting it back into the project. And so that's how we got going, by doing it that way. And it was after 3 years of doing it with that other company, outsourcing to the other company, that we realized, hey, we've got a $2 million online store.
Mm.
Maybe someone might want to buy it.
Mm.
Now, prior to the internet marketing business, we had a chat software company. And prior to the chat software company, we had an IT recruitment business. And we had sold our recruitment company to a company listed on the ASX because we had built this chat software and we wanted to pursue that. The due diligence process of selling that recruitment company was quite rigorous.
Mm.
And we thought, hey, if someone wants to buy Booktopia, $2 million online store, it wouldn't take someone too long to work out it's actually this other company that was doing all the fulfillment and managing the site. That's the company to buy, mm. not Booktopia. And because prior to that, years before, I was a computer programmer and my brother-in-law was an IBM software engineer, we decided to build our own website and part ways with them.
Yep.
So we moved from 60 square meters to 500 square meters, and then we started doing it ourselves.
Mm.
So they're the origins.
To what do you attribute the traction? I mean, just the revenue numbers you were going through, just saying you're up to 100K by the end of the 100K per month by the end of the first year. What do you think you did well and right in the early years to grow at the rate you did?
That is such a great question. And if we had a couple of hours, but there are some key things. So, for example, because we were online marketing experts, I knew how to drive traffic.
Yeah.
I had been spending other people's money to work out how to drive traffic to websites for some time. So instead of targeting search terms like bookshop and bookstore and books, I would target author names or titles. So when someone used Google to do a search, I'd have my ad sitting there and they would click on it and it would go deep into the site where those books were.
Mm.
So it was very targeted. Not everyone in our part of the world knew how to do that. I'm sure Amazon would have already known how to do that. But locally, there wasn't anyone else. So we knew how to do that. One of the things, though, that, for example, in the beginning, when we launched our new site, we put our name up the top, of course, but we also put our address of our internet marketing business in North Sydney and our phone number of our internet marketing business in North Sydney. Because a lot of other people back in the early 2000s would be just, even today, there's still some. It's just a form, you know, like you've got a question, fill out the name, put your name, your email address, and hit submit. But that doesn't build trust.
Mm.
You know, who am I? If I'm going to spend $100 with you, $50, how can I trust that you're actually going to deliver? So we actually put those details up there. So as the business kept going, and by the fourth month, I think it was, we were, as I said, up to $30,000 a month. I thought, you know, what else can we do to build trust? So I thought, maybe we should join the Australian Booksellers Association. So I rang them, and I said, should we join? And they said, of course you should join. It'd be great, join, you should join. How much is it? $400. And I said, okay, what do we get for that? And they said, well, you get discounted postage. And I said, well, this other company who's doing it all for us, the fulfillment company, they're getting the cheap postage. Oh yeah, you're right. What else is there? Well, cheap insurance on your parcels. Well, they handle that. There was nothing that the association could do for us to have any benefit. At the end of the conversation, I said, so, do you have a logo that we could put on our website to say we're an ABA member, Australian Booksellers Association member? Well, no one's ever asked for that before. I said, well, could you? And they said, oh, we'll have to have a committee meeting. So they had a committee meeting. A month later, I get a phone call. We decided to have a logo,
right?
Right? great, we'll become a member. And we put it on our site,
building
trust. Yeah. And in the very early days, because we hadn't won all the awards, we were with, I think back then we were with, I think NAB as our bank, I can't remember who, maybe it was the CBA. Mm. And so we had the banks like, these as our bank. We just put the logos on there to build trust.
Yeah.
And these are some of the things that we did in the beginning to connect with people and make them feel that they could trust us.
That's incredible. That's very, very entrepreneurial, and I can relate to that story a lot. You've got really interesting and meaningful views around the degree to which entrepreneurs should be looking at competition. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I get asked that a lot, and the reason being is because, you know, books, Amazon, even though today, would you believe, Amazon's they just announced $230 billion in revenue for 2018.
Wow.
How much do you reckon of that is books?
I wouldn't know, but I'd say 20%?
Three.
Right.
It's only 3% now.
Right.
But that's $6 billion of books.
Yeah.
That's a lot of books. Yeah. If you think about, we're doing 100, yeah. 110, 113 million. So it's a lot of books, and they are the biggest in the world. But the thing is that my thing about competition is that I know I don't look like it today. For those that you are, who are just listening on podcasts, you're very safe. But when I was younger, I was an athlete, and I was a decathlete, and that's the kind of the 10 events. When you're not good at any particular event, that's the one that you do, and that's what I did.
Right.
And so my best event was the 100 meters. I ran 11 flat, which for a decathlete actually is pretty quick.
Right.
And my sprint coach would say to me, look, if you want to slow down, just look to the side to see where your competition is, right? But if you want to go straight, just look straight down the runway, you know, like I'll look in the camera, straight down the runway, and basically that's where you're focusing.
Mm.
And so if you want to slow down, look at the, now that meant if you want to know where your competition is, have peripheral vision. So kind of be able to look out the corner of your eyes to see where, and I also played basketball at a high level. So peripheral vision, know where your player is. So if you're going to pass it, you don't necessarily need to be looking at them. We kind of treat competition in a similar way. We don't focus on them. We're not wondering what they're doing.
Mm.
But you know, our revenue at 113 million, the number two online book retailer is 20 million.
Right.
So we were all at the same level. We were all at 5 million and 6 million at one point. But by doing that, I think has just meant that we've been laser focused on what we're trying to accomplish.
Mm.
And the others have kind of been looking at other things or looking at us. So I think that's a great metaphor for people, and maybe just ease off a little and not watch. And the other thing is that many years ago when I was speaking at an event, when we had our chat software company, one of our very first customers was an online pharmacy who ended up kind of merging into Chemist Warehouse. And so the guy who ran that, and I was speaking at this event, and I said, so how's it going with Chemist Warehouse? And he goes, look, you know, being the cheapest is a 1 cent war to the bottom. He said, because I had decided not to be the cheapest. I thought, as long as you're in the ballpark, but if you've got it and you can ship it fast, so you're handling the availability, you don't need to be as cheap.
Yeah.
And so we've never, really never desired to be the cheapest.
Yeah.
But if we're kind of in the ballpark, and that's probably the difference between profitability, breaking even, or just just kind of operating under.
The growth has been incredible, but the journey hasn't been without its hard times. Talk to us about some of the hard times you've experienced, and particularly your philosophy around when to pivot, how to pivot, why it's important.
So I'm very fortunate as an entrepreneur to have done a business school in Hawaii back in 93. And it was with Robert Kiyosaki, the guy that wrote Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Now, he actually wrote that a number of years later. So I was already training with him well before he wrote that book.
Mm.
And so this business school in Hawaii was 16 days on the Big Island. We'd start in seven at the morning in your running teams. So you'd have to get up in your running team and run. And then it finished at 2 a.m. in your marketing teams.
Wow.
So we were on the go.
Wow.
And he flew people in from all over the world to go through different types of education, marketing, accounting, negotiation, dressing for success. It was everything. Anyway, on one of the days, he actually said to us, it had nothing to do with the course that was going on, but he said, at the next break, if you could, when you go out, pull a dollar bill, we're in America, pull a dollar bill out of your pocket, wave it around, Now, there was 150 of us in the workshop. So I want you to go out and I want you to sell. Whatever it is that you're doing, sell. And if you're the receiver of being sold to, what I want you to do is I want you to, with integrity, hand over your money, your $1 bill, because that's what you wanted to buy. So I was in recruitment. So I went out there and I went out with gusto, you know, like I was determined. And I was, we have the best service. We're really, you know, we're out there. We massive advertising across all the newspapers. It's huge. We are the best and we're the biggest in Australia. I didn't make one sale. It was really, really annoying because I actually was the best salesman in my company. Mm. So, you know, I kind of go back into the room and I go, that process sucked. You know, that wasn't, you know, this is not the right environment for me to sell recruitment. Course goes on. At the next break, can you get a dollar bill out of your pocket? And I want you to go out there and sell. This time, because it was Hawaii and we were in board shorts and t-shirts, you know, this time I was much more loving. You know, we really take care of our candidates. We listen to what they, you know, to what they have to say, and the clients. We really do a good job matching people together. And people were this time, whereas before they were like, nah, not interested. This time was, oh, Tony, it's so nice. I really love what you're saying. It's beautiful. But this time, I still made no sales. I walk back into the room. That really is a useless process. I hate this process. It sucks. I'm the best salesman in my company. Course goes on. At the next break, he does it again. Out I go. This time I change my tack completely. I sit in the corner with my arms folded and my legs crossed, and I tell him, you can go and get stuff. That didn't work either. So then I kind of walk back into the room. I go, what the hell? I got to think this thing through. What can I do differently to make this work? At the next break, I had remembered that a couple of years before I had done a massage course to be a qualified remedial masseur. I went out and offered 3-minute massages for a dollar. I made $14.
Right.
The lesson that I got in that moment by being able to pivot was really important. So when we had our chat software business, because we had sold our recruitment company to focus on the chat software, and when we did that, a month later there was the dot-com crash of the early 2000s that we got caught up in, and our business was going under. And I was talking to this web designer and I was saying to them, you know, like, how do you get to the top of Google? Because Google had been going for a few years and was getting more and more popular, because if someone did a search for chat software or live help, maybe we'd make a few more sales. So he told me what to do, and we got to the top of Google within a couple of months for live help and chat software. And I was talking to this lady about getting her to use chat software on her website, and she said, look, I'd love to chat to people. I just need more people coming to my site. And I said, oh, I can get you to the top of Google. Well, why don't you give me a proposal? So I did for $500 and did the job, and she was very happy. And because we were in such dire straits because of this dot-com crash and no one really wanted live chat on their websites, and we're sitting around the table going, maybe we're going to have to get permanent jobs, you know, because I was with my family, you know, we're all in the business together. And I was talking to the largest independent car rental company in New Zealand about chat software. Same conversation occurred. Love to chat to people, just need more people coming to the site. I can get you to the top of Google, give me a proposal. So instead of putting a proposal in for $500, I put one in for $18,000.
Wow.
I spoke to the guy for an hour on the phone about all the things we're going to do for his website and driving traffic and transforming his business. And at the end of the hour, he said, all right, let's do it.
Wow.
I put down the phone, I turned to my family, I said, shit, we're in big trouble now. We have no idea what we're doing. But from daybreak to midnight, we learned the art of driving traffic into websites. And I can assure you, it was that experience in Hawaii when I had to pivot to focus on the cash. You know, where are people going to hand over money? Because that's what funds your business. Super, super important. And sometimes people get so fixated, but this is my idea, this is what I was aiming. And they can't understand. I thought there was the market there. I'd done all this research. Sometimes, and I can assure you, I've shared that story with lots of people, and I'll tell you a great story. So a guy came to me, introduction through his wife, a number of years ago, several years ago, and he was selling chandeliers on eBay from Tasmania. And we had the same conversation. I told him that story. Forgot about him. I don't know, about a year or so, I don't know, 18 months later, I get a phone call, or I was at an event, and he came up to me, and he goes, Tony, we now do $90,000 a month. We changed from selling chandeliers to selling LED lighting, and it's gone crazy.
Right.
And it was that story.
Wow.
But he was passionate about his chandeliers, and he loved his chandeliers. So I think sometimes, you know, whoever's listening,
get romantic about.
Yeah, you got to. Sometimes you just got to let it go.
I absolutely love that. Follow the cash. The other thing you talk about, Tony, is disconnecting yourself from your business. What do you mean by that?
So that's a good one. Just imagine you own a Maserati. I actually did at one stage. I bought it on Grays Online accidentally. I put a bid in and then you get a note to say, congratulations. You. So yeah, I ended up with a Maserati. And right. And as Maseratis are known to be, they're in the workshop a lot, you know, with the mechanic.
Yes, I know. I've got one. So trust me, we know.
There we go.
Yeah.
Talking to the guy. So, Jack, just imagine, right, you've got your Maserati, but as Maseratis are prone to be done, they're in the workshop. And so your mechanic gives you the loaner. And it's the 15-year-old two-door Fiat, right? And you've got a super, super important appointment and presentation to some new customers,
yeah,
right, down in Double Bay. And you've got to get there. You gave yourself enough time and you figure, well, it's the loaner. I'll just park in the back streets and I'll walk around. Every single parking spot is taken. The only one available is right in front of the cafe restaurant where you're having the meeting with these new clients that you're supposed to impress, right? And it's not the Maserati, you get out of the car and they recognize you and you see them and they're looking at you in your Fiat and you're going, yeah, it's not, you know, I own a Maserati. This is not mine, right? You got to be able to get out of that car as you. The car is not who you are, right? You got to get out and you got to be able to walk up to them, right? Because you are not your car. You are not your wife. You're not your husband. You're not your kids. You're not your sports team, right? You are not your business. And this understanding that is so important to be able to give yourself some distance between you, because when Booktopia wins, I don't know, New South Wales Business of the Year, that's Booktopia winning it, not Tony Nash, right? It's not, when people come up to me and they say to me, oh, I love Booktopia, they're not coming up and saying, I love Tony Nash, because they love that when they buy online and it gets delivered and it's real quick, right? It's really, really important. And I can assure you that separation, so I'll tell you, this is true. I remember when I started Booktopia and I was walking through the apartment and I just walked past the door where my computer was and I stopped dead in my tracks. Because I could hear boom, 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 boom. I could actually hear the heartbeat of the business being born. It was at that level, you know, it was in its cot. I remember when it crawled. I remember when it took its first steps. I remember when it went to daycare for a day. I remember when it went to daycare for a week, to primary school, to high school, to uni, and now it's out on its own. So that kind of separation has enabled me to look at Booktopia and go, what does it actually need right now? And I remember a great time, it was in 2010, and we were doing so well, and we hit a bit of a growth spurt, and we had a bit of a cash crunch. And my brother, who handled the finances still, and we had a consulting CFO who worked with us, my brother was in London on a book buying opportunity, and I was taking care of the money. There was not enough money, right? And so I put on all these sales and I sold all this stuff and I just went crazy to sell as much as I could to generate as much cash. And then once we kind of got through that, I sat down with our consulting CFO, who'd been working one day a week, 2 days a week. I said to him, you know, it really feels like we need a CFO right now. And he goes, you know what, I've been thinking about that for the last 4 weeks as well. And it's that kind of separation going, what does Booktopia need right now? What is it? And to give it greater insight, I believe, I honestly believe this is true, is that in the past, my own personal values and judgments about who I am and what I've, like when I was a recruiter, recruiting, I had IT contractors working for me. And I got to 15 contractors working for me, and then it would go back down to 10. Then I got it up to 15, and then I got... Right, and then I did a personal development workshop and I worked on a few things on myself. And within 3 months, I was at 30 contractors working for me.
Right.
And then I got stuck at 30. And then I went back and did some more work on myself and, you know, challenged my values and my beliefs. I went to 45. And then I got stuck at 45 and I would drop back. What can I get? And so there was something else that I had to work through. So these glass ceilings that sit there that you don't know and you kind of feel like, why can't I get my business past $500,000 a year? Or why am I stuck at $5 million? Or what? But I honestly believe that the way that Booktopia has been able to grow organically, consistently, is that I've kind of done it in a way that it's not me. Mm. So my ego is not locked into, you know, who that company is and what it is. It's not something you'd learn probably in a textbook or in some sort of course, but that's how it plays out.
Mm. It's fascinating to hear you talk about the personal development workshops and courses were really the catalyst that enabled you to take the next step change in growth. One of my primary beliefs is that a business only grows as the people do, right? And so you often need to shed old identities and shed old limiting beliefs and who am I today and how can I best help drive the business. What do you think it was about the personal development workshops and courses that enabled such incredible commercial step changes each step of the way?
Robert Kiyosaki said this, and he's probably repeated it from someone else, but he's found that the biggest return on investment you can make is educating yourself.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that because I know you actually do that. That's your business, but it's the truth. So I honestly feel that the more that I educate myself, the more that I've a value that I bring. And one of the things that I try and when I do my keynotes or talk, the first thing I actually start with is that the quality of your life is determined by the quality of the questions you can ask.
Yeah.
So, and I share an example. So we do a lot of philanthropic work, and through that we've worked with the Kathy Freeman Foundation, and we give books to them as kids up in far north Queensland and Northern Territory. When they're in school, and these are Indigenous kids, if they complete the half year and the end of the year, they get a book pack from us. And so part of being involved in that, once a year, there's a group that come down and visit all of the sponsors and comes to Sydney, and so they end up at Booktopia. And I get to spend a few minutes with them. And so I tell them that the quality of your life is determined by the quality of questions that you ask. And I give them an example. I said, all right, imagine I'm coming up to Palm Island, and when I get there, I say to you guys, where's the best place to go fishing? Now, one of the guys who had been in the room, he was looked like he was asleep, but he was kind of like, you know, with the cap down, he's 16, 17 years old, cap down, right? And he looks up and he goes, I'm not telling you that, you know, because that's the best place to fish.
Yeah.
I said, that's a good answer. He's never going to tell me where the best place to fish is. I said, good one. All right, what about the fourth best place to fish? And they gave me a name of a place. I said, great. Off I go. I come back. I have not caught one fish. What didn't I ask? What's the best time to go fishing? I'm charging off there in the middle of the day. No, break of dawn or dusk. Thank you. Off I go again. I caught nothing. What else didn't I ask?
Bait.
What bait should I take? Right? If you're a doctor, if you're a lawyer, if you're, you know, you're a nurse, if you're a teacher, if you're an interviewer, the quality of your life is determined by the quality of the questions you ask. So if you can learn to ask better questions, then, and so this is all part of the education. And it's about being able to ask those questions and then you know, work with that information. So I think one of the things about investing in myself is when I went in there, initially my very first one, I was very much sitting on the wall. Very judgmental, you know, like a lot of self-talk about this is a load of rubbish. You know, there was an American program, you know, the American wankers, you know, like that's. And then there was something that happened during the middle of that course that just, you know, completely broke down my belief system, and I completely flipped. And then I was just like, I'm going to continue to invest, and I did that. And then running your own business is an investment as well. You have things come up. We were talking earlier. Before we got on set, and about those challenges that come up, and they're the biggest learnings you can have when you get. It's easy when everything's going well, but as soon as something difficult comes up, well, how are you going to address that?
Yeah.
And that's why running a business is one of the best courses you can ever do.
Best personal development courses.
Absolutely, absolutely. And getting married, that's the other one.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I might interview you when I come to that stage of my life as well.
There you go. Speak to my wife, you get all the right answers.
Speaking of difficult times in business, 2016, you prepared for an IPO. You'd raised $4 million to execute the IPO. And then Amazon announced it was going to enter the market. and you therefore changed your plans around the IPO. Talk to us about that period and the challenges that that threw up.
Okay, I just need to correct you there. We never raised $4 million.
Right.
We actually spent $4 million. So, and about that is because we actually never, and this is really important in terms of raising capital, we never accumulated the money so we could then have it over here ready to, we actually used the money that we were doing by selling more books and then trying to use that money to go through that process. Right. So there was a real huge stretch and put a lot of pressure on our suppliers because we were taking longer to pay them. And so we had to really work with them. And so the thing is that when we wanted to list on the ASX, we wanted to do it well. And rather than just going with some small organizations, we wanted to go with the big end of town, do it properly so people would take us seriously. So we had spent most of 2016 preparing for that. And the month that we were about to list, or you know, we're getting close to getting a price and the prospectus was done, Amazon announced they were coming to Australia. And all of the fund managers said, we're out. You know, Amazon's coming, they're not going to survive, or all those forecasts you're not going to hit, which of course we have since their arrival. But so it was more about that situation. Now, how long it took me to get over that was about 3 hours. And it felt like one door closed and another 10 opened. This is really important, actually, to understand the way that my mind works here. And that is that one of those workshops that I did many years ago was that one, this one was a bit out there in terms of what I would know. It wasn't business, it was called Spiritual Mastery, and went over 10 weeks. And what we did, every week we looked at different things, like, I don't know, yoga and meditation and other things. And during one of those weeks, he said, the guy who was running it, a Greek-Australian guy, he had spent 14 years in India as a becoming a Swami. And he was telling us a story that a weekend, a Friday, Saturday, Sunday workshop, they had 800 people arriving to this place in India, and they were going to run this meditation retreat. And what happened was, an hour before that was going to start on the Friday morning, his Swami was running the whole course. And word got through that his Swami's Swami, the great Swami, had died. And so he heard the news, he rushes off, shuts his dressing room door, and that's it. And everyone's standing around going, oh my God, you know, like, that's terrible news. The great Swami has died. Oh my, we've got 800 people arriving in an hour. What are we going to do? And oh no, he's going to be really upset. 15 minutes later, this guy walks out of the dressing room completely clean and clear. And he had mastered the art of grieving without resistance. And it was such an odd thing to hear. I don't know why, of all the 10 weeks of everything that we did, that was the one, I don't know, it was probably story. Like a 15-minute story,
yeah.
Right? It was just like, what the hell? What do you mean grieving without resistance? And so I started to ponder that, and I started to see the things that I was doing. I remember when I was in recruitment, I was the best salesman in our company, and we moved from a little pokey little office on Elizabeth Street to Piccadilly Tower, 27th floor, views across the harbour, right? And I got given the office that looked onto Park Regis where I could see everyone getting changed in the morning, right? And so I was furious. Like, I literally walked out of the office, I walked the streets, I was pissed off with my boss. Why, you know, I'm the best salesman in the company, why am I getting to look at that, right? And I came back in and I called my boss in and I looked at him, and as I was about to talk to him, I burst into tears, right? And I told him exactly how I felt. He listened to me, didn't make it. Listen to me, he goes, Tony, I hear what you're saying, but this is your office. And he walked out. And I look around, I go, well, this is the money-making center. This is where it's all, you know, they wish they had this office. And so I had to reframe. But the thing was, is learning how to grieve and dealing with disappointment. And one of the things I like to do is break up words. So if you look at the word disappointment, you know, an appointment. I've got an appointment. I had an appointment to come and see you here. We've got an appointment. I've got to catch up with the doctor. I've got to have a haircut. I've got an appointment. How can a word so neutral, and you put a dis in front of it, have so much heavy emotion? What the hell? How does that work? Why? Because you had an expectation about something happening at a certain time.
Yeah.
It didn't happen. what didn't happen, and you're able to dissect it, therefore you're able to grieve, then you're able to let it go, and then you move on.
Yeah.
So with the IPO, the reason why I tell you all these stories,
yeah,
going back,
brilliant.
Yeah, coming back. Yep. So I was able to do that. Now my deputy CEO is a lot younger. He's 20 years younger than me. Mm-hmm. It took him about 3 weeks to get over it. Mm. But this is the thing, it's like, if you're in business, and I think, you know, for those that are listening today, most of them, from what I understand, are, it's an emotional roller coaster. Mm. You know, like, something amazing happened, right? Then, something amazing happened, then something really unexpected and just, that really sucked happened, and then something incredible happened, and you can go through the highs and lows.
Mm.
So what I do is I clip the highs,
yep,
and I clip the lows.
Yep.
Now, if you measure, like, if that was time elapsed, right, and this is, you know, zero time and time, like, just look at the amount of distance you're traveling going, yep, through the highs and lows as time is passing,
yep,
whereas I'm going here. Mm. So in terms of entrepreneurial, you know, CEO sustainability,
mm,
it is much easier to do this. So when we won the business awards, awesome, that's great, fantastic, mm, great news. Next day, what's next?
Mm.
So if you want to ride the roller coaster, and the thing about riding the roller coaster is as you know you're going down, and this is where some of the grieving thing came in, is that as you're going down, for me in the old days, I would kind of, if it was a roller coaster, I was putting the metaphorical handbrake on. I do not want to go down there. Like, being down there sucks, right? But what happens if you put the brakes on, you lose all your momentum, you are down there.
Mm.
And back in the old days, it was pizzas, ice cream, Coke, and about 6 videos from the video store, and you see me tomorrow, right? But today, it's take my arms off, right? Let's get down there. Let's grieve. What feelings do I literally and genuinely need to feel? Feel those feelings.
Mm.
Like, really feel those feelings. It's not like faking the feelings. It's, mm, like, if they're real for you, you better bloody feel them,
mm,
because they're true. But then you felt them and they're validated, and then whoosh, then you got momentum. So you kind of go, so you go down fast and then you're up.
Mm.
And so you actually spend less time down here than you do up there.
That is an incredible metaphor. What are your meditation practices today?
None.
You don't meditate?
I don't.
I'm surprised by that.
A lot of people ask me that,
yeah,
but I think what I do is it's about, to me, it's really about just that being grounded.
You're very mindful,
yeah,
but not meditating. And so the Swami course you spoke about, where there's the Swami.
Mm.
What was that around, that particular course? And what
that was
doing
a course called Spiritual Mastery,
yeah,
with a guy called Michael Adamides. It was a 10-week course just to explore all the different modalities.
Right,
and
right.
So it was just one of the extra different types of courses. I thought I'll just invest in that. And it was odd because I wasn't expecting to get that outcome or that learning.
Mm.
But by putting yourself in there,
mm,
it was actually a really important one in the end. But
mm,
I've done a lot of different things,
yeah,
over the years to,
yeah,
to challenge myself.
Yeah.
And I must admit that when I go in and do some sort of work, I do literally go in and give it 100%.
Yeah.
And then I try and take what I can out of it, and then I'm out, and then I'm back in the real world.
Yep.
I was never like a course junkie. Like, I was,
yeah,
just going there for the good feeling and,
yeah,
hugging people and feeling validated,
yeah,
right? And trying to hit on women, right?
Yeah.
Although that's what happens when you're in a loving environment quite, yeah, often. But but it was really
you're
about
there for the right reasons.
Yeah, it was really about me and what can I do to challenge myself, and it served me really well.
Absolutely. Question from Sophie Vyong from Instagram. How important has it been for you to invest in automation and developing systems as your business has scaled?
Absolutely important.
Mm.
I mean, so what we have done, and we've done that, so we've got $10 million of automation. We built our own website,
mm,
our own content systems. I wrote the algorithms for the reordering and the pricing, which I've now handed over to much more accomplished people in that area. But we wrote our back-end systems. So we developed it at all. We do, because of our IT background, it's always a buy versus build. So can we build it or should we buy it? So,
yeah,
there are things in there that we have plugged in.
Yeah.
So investing is super important because with the scale, you know, like, you got to understand, we moved into our current facility in 2014, we were shipping around 7,000 books a day. We now do 30,000 books in and 30,000 books out per day.
Wow.
You cannot throw more people at that and have that be sustainable.
Right.
You actually get diseconomies of scale. So
mm,
so investing is really, really important.
Mm.
And saying that, though, our workforce has grown from I think 58 when we moved in, to over 200 now. So there's still a lot more people today than there were then.
Absolutely. And finally, Tony, some rapid fire questions before. I do want to talk to you about your crowdfunding campaign. What's a popular piece of business advice that you vehemently do not agree with?
Ooh, that's an interesting. I've never been asked that one before. Or if I have, I've forgotten. I prefer to be spontaneous. I think, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, so therefore I'm a rule breaker. So therefore, if someone says that that's the way it is, I love to hear that, actually.
Yeah.
So it's, I think, not accepting the status quo. A lot of people do that, and of course a lot of entrepreneurs do that because they see what the others can't see. I remember when I the business was growing, and I got a call from a government committee that was being formed called the Book Industry Strategy Group. And what they did was they had brought all of these groups together. So they had printers, they had literary agents, authors, big authors, independent authors, smaller authors, small bookshops, big chains, big publishers, little publishers. They're all been invited to sit on the strategy group, and they rang me and they said, Tony, we'd really like to have an online bookstore. I said, oh, you don't want me. I'm going to piss people off with what I've got to say. No, be good. Nah, hang up. Anyway, about half an hour later, the guy that was running the whole thing gave me a call, and he said, look, I heard you didn't want to be involved, and I understand that, but can I just talk to you? And I said, sure. And we talked for a while, and he explained all the people that were going to be there. And I said, look, all right, I'll join. I said, but I just want to ask you one important question. Have the most important group of all been invited to sit on your strategy group? And there's silence. No, they haven't. The readers, the customers. My experience of the book industry is most of the time people are thinking about what books they want to publish and the next big book, and they're making all their money off the backlist. It's actually books that were written 10, 15 years ago, which is paying for everything, but they're more interested about the next big book. So my experience of breaking rules is mostly about just seeing what the others can't see, and that's a lot of what we've done. So for example, what have I done? People ask me, what did you do? I cheat. I go to America and the UK and watch what's going on over there, and then come back here and go, is there anything different? And that's one of the reasons why we got into stock, because I could see that if you had the stock, that the experience of buying online was just so much better. And when I came back, I said, we've got to hold more stock, because we had already had been doing that and was working really well. So I think just not accepting the status quo.
What habit have you developed that's had the biggest impact on your life?
I'm really focused on, you know, I've got the horizon point.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm heading. And I answer that in a way, I'm going to answer it this way. So having ADHD, and the only reason I found out that I have ADHD is that my wife, who we've been married for 4 years, noticed my stepson, who's 15, had certain kind of behavioral things, and she was, you know, in my ear about it, and I'm going, that's just a normal boy, that's how I was, right? And so, well, I'm not sure exactly what's going on here, because, you know, it's not normal. So he got diagnosed with ADHD, and he's completely transformed. His results have gone from B's to straight A's. He's compliant. He'll even ask my wife, you know, can I help you with anything? And I know that his mum says the same thing at his house. So. So having had ADHD, they say is, you know, it's a mental health condition, but actually I call it a superpower. Because with ADHD, you really love to do what you want to do, and you'd really hate doing what you don't want to do. And that's how it kind of came up with my wife, you know, because she was nagging me about all the things. But the reason why I've been so successful is I was just so obsessed about doing those things that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So if anyone does have ADHD, it's a real winner if you're an entrepreneur, I believe. And I encourage you to continue to focus on that. But I think from being obsessed about you know, about an outcome and not really, you know, even now there's chatter in the company about this or that. And I go, just focus. We're focused on that.
Horizon point. If you went back to the day you started Booktopia, what is the one piece of advice you'd give yourself then, knowing what you know now?
This is going to be massive. Like, we had no idea. So, and I think if you, like if, but that's an interesting thing. So you don't know. So why not just start telling yourself that anyway?
Yeah.
So whoever's listening to right now, just do that. You know, just, you've got no idea whether this is going to be massive. So just why don't you just imagine that it is?
Yeah.
Hey, what's that going to do to your outcome?
Yeah.
Doesn't, you know, it's probably going to help.
Yeah.
I can't see it hindering. So no. I think that would be the only probably thing. I mean, if you told my brother that we were going to have like 13,000 square meters and the rent's going to be in the millions and you've got 200 employees, he would have just fallen over and what? Because he's really risk averse. So I think that, you know, that was one of the, that was, actually just on that, I will answer, how much time do we have?
As much as we like.
Great. I want to share this story with you because it's really important. So what happened a few years ago, we had a new HR manager. And she'd come in and she spent time with us and she sat me down one day and she said, Tony, your company is stuffed. People are going to be leaving all over the place. I said, what do you mean? She goes, oh, well, IT is really, you know, they hate marketing and marketing hate IT and they're all at each other's throats and, you know, because they've all been in her office telling her what's going on. I said, really? Okay. So I went over and spoke to the head of IT. I said, boy, you really must hate marketing. What do you mean? Well, no, those guys are geniuses. Well, what about hating, you know, like this whole story about hate? Yeah, they frustrate the hell out of me, you know, they're late with delivering all the assets for all the stuff that needs to go up on the website. It drives us crazy. It's, oh my God, it's annoying. But what they know about books and how they can promote is incredible. Oh, okay, fair enough. So then off I go to speak to marketing. You guys really must hate IT. What do you mean? Those guys are legends. They are geniuses. What they do with IT is incredible. Well, what about this whole thing? Oh yeah, they want all this stuff. They never, you know, we've got all these things that we want to deliver, but they take so long and we're not prioritized. It drives us crazy. Okay. So, all right. So I could see what was going on. So the business went on and this lady decided to resign a few months later. So I asked, do you mind if we just have an exit interview? And she said, of course. Which I wouldn't normally do, but I had an exit interview and I kind of conversations going on and I asked her, so just if you wouldn't mind me asking a question, you know, because you talked that time about everyone hating each other, would you say like if a company needs to go somewhere, everyone needs to row together? She goes, exactly. You guys aren't rowing together. I said, well, I don't subscribe to that thinking. She goes, what do you mean? I said, well, like the way that I see things happening is that in a boat, if you've got the wind behind you and you want to go as fast as you can, you put up the spinnaker. And when you put up the spinnaker, you've got three corners, they're all pulling in different directions. And a boat with a spinnaker on where everyone's pulling in different directions goes much faster than everyone rowing together. And I knew that from working with my brother, because my brother annoys the crap out of me because he's so risk averse. But he tempered my marketing and my, you know, like I knew that I want to do that, I want to do this, I want to do that. But actually, by having him anchoring me and keep, what's Simon going to say about doing that and spending all that money? I've got to somehow justify doing that and getting the business case around it.
Yeah.
So sometimes in your organization, it might seem like everything's falling apart, but actually, if everyone is kind of committed to the same outcomes and the same goals, and you've got this friction and it's just not. It just may be that it's the spinnaker and not just rowing together, because rowing together is really, really slow. And that, I think, it's really important to understand the dynamic of, especially as an entrepreneur and you're leading the company and you've just got to manage all the motivations. But, you know, we've got an incredible team in our company and incredibly motivated, and they own it. They are literally, you know, carrying the weight on their shoulders and spreading the load.
It's a fantastic metaphor. Tony, I'm really interested to talk to you about your crowdfunding campaign, which a lot of people are talking about at the moment. It's an exciting project. Talk to us about what's happening there.
Yeah, so, well, first of all, we talked about the IPO.
Yeah.
And the IPO in 2016 that never happened. And when my brother and brother-in-law and I, we sat down and we thought, let's actually do this, because, you know, we've got 5 million people that have bought from us. There's 2 million people on our database that we're emailing. Maybe they'll all be able to get involved. What we found out is they never get invited, because the fund managers will invest and then they have a retail sophisticated investor network where the advisors tell these people about all the deals going on and should you invest in this. Not one customer got invited. So that was even though we just still went with it, it was like, oh, I didn't realize it worked that way. That's a bit, it wasn't what we were expecting. And so in September 2017, there was some legislation that went through that equity crowdfunding is able to be, for capital, is now being legislated. So that means that as a business, you can actually go out to your customers, the retail world, and say, would you like to buy shares in our company?
Yep.
And so when we kind of came across that, we thought, oh, that sounds quite interesting because we've got so many customers. And so therefore, why not let them invest in us? So that's why we decided. And that's actually running at the moment. Mm. We've got over 730 people who have invested thus far.
Wow.
We've just extended the timing because we actually launched it just before Christmas.
Right.
And it was closing actually this week. And we realized Christmas, New Year's is not a great time for everyone to think about these things. So we've extended it till mid-June. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we're going to continue to pursue that. So I think from what I've seen is that equity crowdfunding is going to be huge. And I'll give you the mathematical insight to that. And this is what really pisses a lot of people off, is that when we were doing the IPO, we were going to do a $30 million capital raise. And it was going to cost us $8 million to raise that money.
Yeah.
Now, as I said before, earlier on, we actually wanted the big boys to do it. We didn't give it to the cheaper guys. So I asked our chairman. Our chairman is a guy that was the chairman for Dexus, which is an ASX 50 company.
Yeah.
So he's been with us for a couple of years. I said, what's the cheapest you reckon we could do to do a proper IPO for that kind of capital raise? He said, look, $5 million is probably, with all the broker fees and lawyers, et cetera, $5 million is probably, you know, maybe four, but let's just say five at the bottom end. So to raise $30 million, $5 million.
Yeah.
To do a $10 million capital raise through equity crowdfunding is $290,000.
Right.
So call it $300,000.
Yeah.
Multiply that by three is $900,000. So 5 million or 8 million versus 900,000, it is cheap.
Mm.
More importantly, we're getting a bit of flack, or we're getting this commentary from the finance world that they do not like this.
Yeah.
Why? Because they've been riding the gravy train for the last, I don't know, decades. They're living in Balmoral, Vaucluse, right? They've got all Maseratis and whatever else, right? They're just making so much money. And I love it because it's disruption.
Yeah.
And I reckon that there's going to, because people who are customers actually really know your business quite well. And that's why I think investing. And if anyone's listening today and they want to get involved, by all means do. Mm. As they say, please read all the information properly before you invest. Check with your financial advisor. But go on to the equitize.com. EQUITISE.com, Equitize. They're the ones that are doing it for us. Just check it out.
Mm.
Actually, a lot of people have come to me. I get a lot of calls or LinkedIn messages now that say, about your crowdfunding. And I say, how are you doing that? Because I can just tell that this is going to be more and more popular. And popular to the point, what I like about it for the finance industry, even though they're kind of fearing it at the moment, or you know, that they realize it's a disruptor, actually it's good for them. And I'm sure they hate me saying it, but what it means is that customers are going to put over their money to get involved early to then help the company get to this level when they've been able to allow the other bigger investors to get involved, when they've kind of proven and demonstrated that actually that thought that they had, or that business that was here, which is now here, is worth investing in.
Yeah.
So it's actually minimizing their risk. So I'm excited about that for them. They can't see it yet, but I do believe that's actually how it's going to eventually play out, is that it's actually going to change the modeling. Mm. But we're already big.
Mm.
And most of the time I get asked, well, why are you doing it? You know, you've got to 113 million, you're going to get to 200 million, you're going to get to 300. We know that. But it's just so great to have others involved now.
Yeah.
We've got to that point where we actually want other people to share in the success that we've had.
Share in the growth journey.
Get them on board. We've still got a long ways to go.
Mm.
And that's why we're excited about it, and about having shareholders on board. And it doesn't, and people say, getting listed or getting getting shareholders. You know, it's like, bring it on.
It represents a great opportunity for your customers and your community and our community and entrepreneurs and people all around Australia who love Booktopia to actually participate in the growth story.
Mm.
I mean, that's a great thing to do.
It is. It's good, and I think Because we've grown for so many years, and our vision is to continue to grow, it's nice for more people to, I mean, our customers have enjoyed our growth. They've bought more books. They love us winning awards. They tell us, and we're getting faster, and we're holding more stock, and it's just, you just hear it more and more often. So I think to able to introduce that equity conversation as well, I think is really great.
Tony, those that are interested in the crowdfunding campaign can go and check you out on Equitize. Those that want to follow you and follow your journey, learn more from Tony Nash, how do they best do that?
I always say to people, just go LinkedIn, Tony Nash, Booktopia. Just connect with me, ask me questions. I always get back to people.
Wow.
So you can connect with me in that way.
Team, definitely take Tony up on that. As you've seen from this interview, he is an absolute wealth of knowledge and incredibly generous with it. Tony, thank you so much for coming on the Jack Lewis podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to chat to you.
No worries.
Thanks for tuning into today's podcast. I'm Jack DeLosa. If you enjoyed listening, make sure you hit subscribe and you'll be the first in line to get every new episode sent directly to your phone. While you're at it, open Instagram and connect with me. My handle is simply at Jack DeLosa, DELOSA. This is where you'll find me every day sharing the secrets of scaling multi-million dollar businesses and giving you a behind the scenes look at what it really takes to build a life that you love. You can also find me on all the usual places, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. Just search Jack DeLosa. Thanks again for listening, and as always, dream out loud. That's a wrap. Yeah!